You can see my award-winning climate comedy show Spoilers at a festival near you, provided you live near or are going to McCunclith or Wells comedy festivals. More dates added soon near you, conceivably, who knows what might happen.
And if you are at Mac, come and see ComCom Redacted live at 4 p.m. on the Saturday.
Go to stuartgoldsmith.com and click the very attractive banner image to find out more.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot. We charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Welcome to the show. I'm Stuart Goldsmith. Today I am talking with Suze Kempner. Yes, her of the Sonic the Hedgehog haircut, the incredible Twitter output, the very funny online videos and the brilliant stuff on Twitch. Suze is the very definition of a cult comedian, and I invite you to come for the musical theatre and stay for the trauma, as she did in her very first show, her first Edinburgh show, which, as we will hear, was an absolutely extraordinary entry into the world of doing Edinburgh shows. I won't spoiler it for you unless you've read the show notes, in which case you probably already know. But absolutely staggering intro from the Asda Kate Bush, Suze Kempner. And we are going to have a fantastic conversation. So I hope you enjoy it. There are 20 minutes of extras, including Suze, on storytelling via nostalgia and the challenges of her handsome brother being on TV a lot. We'll get into those in the Insiders Club extras, which are available at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But we're going to talk now to the only girl that didn't do ballet in school. We're going to learn about self-belief, how to wind up reply guys, and how to maintain one's armour via creative success. This is a really lovely conversation. This is Suze Kempner. Hello, Suze Kempner. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I didn't know what to expect from your Zoom window when I saw you, because there are a million tiny versions of Suze in my head, some of them with beards, doing Doc Cotton impersonations. Your green screen work is, I mean, it's what's the word? Not frequent, not numerous. What's the word for when there's a fuck ton of it?
Oh, yeah. High quantity? Oh, prolific?
Prolific, I think.
Which always sounds really good, doesn't it? If something's prolific, but...
Yes. Yeah. All it really means is lots. Yeah. 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 So you are... I've been enjoying loads of your stuff online. And I saw your show as well. I saw Mega Drive and really laughed out loud at the point I realised what the Mega Drive was had been kind of fitted into.
Shoehorned.
Shoehorned is the word again. Yeah. So I've been seeing lots of your stuff and I'm excited to talk to you about. You're also on Twitch, which I'm afraid I haven't seen any of your stuff on Twitch.
Oh, don't worry. It's very unplanned.
Okay, I'll fair do. Okay. So I suppose my question is, I feel like seeing more of you... over the course of the pandemic, and I wonder whether that is the algorithm has registered that I like watching your stuff, or whether you have become like prodigious in your output. I feel like you're chucking out more content than most.
I think I probably am. Yeah. We're coming up on, I mean, today's the 9th of March, isn't it? So we're coming up about 10 days away from that first lockdown.
Yeah.
And they announced, I remember, they announced we won't be able to film any more EastEnders. It's going to go down to 2 days a week. And within 18 hours, I'd put out my first episode of EastEnders in lockdown, which was the first time I'd ever used my green screen. Ah. And yeah, like I had a captive audience. I'm a big show off.
Yeah.
So here you go. Here you go, everybody. Here's stuff all the time.
Yeah, it sort of makes sense, I suppose, in my idea of what a Suze Kempner is, that you be... Like you kind of wear your, I think, the phrasing I think for an old press release of yours was like wanting to worm your way into the West End. You wear that very much on your sleeve. Like what I want to do is achieve big kind of West End Wendy type, you know, that's the goal or one of the goals. And it's almost like it reminds me of like the Pompidou Centre. You're kind of wearing the architecture of that very visibly.
Right. Yeah, I don't... Oh, God. I wish I was really cool and could go like, yeah, ultimately, I just, as long as I'm doing good work, that's okay. It's like, no, I already knew that. I wanna, can't I be extremely successful? It's not even famous, but yeah, I am trying to worm my way into my dream job all the time. Yeah.
So when the pandemic came along, were you like, what have your living circumstances been over the last year? Are you living with anyone, or are you, because your output is someone I assume it's like that kind of John Robertson, it's just me and these four walls, man. So gotcha. I'm just going to, I'm always on.
Well, my living situation hasn't changed at all because I've been living in my mum's house for coming up on 8 years. The house and living situation didn't change. My mum isn't even around more because she works outdoors. So she's been able to keep working.
Okay.
And yeah, it's just for up until about a month ago when my room became a studio space because I got to rearrange it. I would just go, right, I'm making something in the lounge now. And she'd go, watch iPlayer upstairs. She was fine with that, by the way.
Okay, I'll fit it. So we get a sense of the volume of time you're spending making it, how much of, what does your week look like at the moment? And are you kind of routined? We'll get onto the work in a minute, but I'm just fascinated with how you've managed to kind of chuck so much stuff out.
Okay. It's not really any routine because I'm part of two podcasts that go out every week. So there's a few hours a week recording those over Zoom. If I get an idea for a video, because I'm a naturally quite lazy person, I have to go, right, I have to do it now. Otherwise, I'll think about it too much and then find a reason to not do it. So, yeah. I don't have a dedicated Twitch streaming schedule because if I did, I'd never stick to it. So instead, I'll go like, yeah, I feel like doing this today.
Yes.
And then I'll just say on Twitter, I'm doing this today.
Okay. Yeah. That's interesting because that's a very, I mean, already you're kind of saying, oh, I'm so lazy that I'd have to do this. That's a classic workaholic thing to say, right? Like, oh God, I've got to motivate myself, otherwise I just sit there like a big slug.
Right.
You know, but also I'm interested in that, that seems like a really useful technique for, if I have an idea, I will immediately do the idea.
Yeah.
That feels like the sort of thing that, you know, people, probably coaches, say to teams. You mean that's like an established, you know, do the thing, be creative, do it now.
It probably is, yeah. I have to use that with exercise and stuff as well.
Okay.
If I wake up in the morning and go, right, I must exercise today, I won't do it. I have to just do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
For like 8 whole minutes.
Impressive. No, it's better than no minutes.
Exactly. Exactly.
So I'm kind of trying to put a picture together of who you are. I suppose I first knew you as the Sonic the Hedgehog woman, right? Because some of those images were very arresting. And then I think we gigged together. We did Beat This for Rob Deering.
Yes!
Was that in the last Edinburgh that happened? Was it 2019 or the one before? Because they have all
I
want to
say it was 2018. Okay. No, it must have been 2019 because that's when I put the Sonic hat
yes,
on.
Yes, okay. Okay.
No, and that's a literal Sonic hat. It's not a metaphorical Sonic hat.
Yeah, which hat do you put on first?
I just put on the Sonic hat today, reaches into a box of hats.
And so I sort of knew you as, I suppose in that way that at Edinburgh, loads of faces on posters and you get a sense, like you might see someone do a kind of like a thematic conceit 1 year. Mm. And I just, you know, I'm a sort of hoary old veteran of many, many Edinburgh festivals. And now I'm just like, okay, so-and-so is doing a thing or a face is doing a thing. And then I suppose by that time I'd gone, oh, that's Suze. She does computer stuff because it had become a kind of thing. So just talk us through your, look, you've done a bunch. What have you done, like 8 Edinburgh hours now, 7 or 8?
I think that was the 7th. 2019 was the 7th.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just talk us through the kind of the starting point and the way what you're putting out there has morphed and why. Because I think it kind of went from I'm the musical theatre person to I've massively gone niche, not just on video games, but specifically one video game.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah. So 2014 was my first Edinburgh and I knew I wanted to do a show. I had no concept. I've been doing comedy about 5 years and I had no concept of you make your Edinburgh debut because I went up there self-produced and there was no interest. So I went, I can do whatever I like for an hour. It doesn't matter because probably no one will come to see it anyway. So I did this show called Defying Gravity. I knew I wanted to talk about my parents' divorce, which happened to me as an adult, and read out a lengthy email my dad had sent at the end of 2010, which made my mum leave him like the next day. Because at the beginning of 2011, when my mum had first left, we would like shell-shocked war veterans go around family friends' houses, and she'd go bring the email, which she'd printed out, which I think is weird, but
okay.
it was a 7,500 word email, and then she'd get me to read it out in his voice while we would like scream with laughter with family friends at this crazy email. And so I knew that was always going to be my first Edinburgh show.
Oh my God.
And then I added in the Songs of Wicked.
Talk about an origin. So that, I mean, you were already performing comedy. You've been doing comedy for a few years. Okay. But to me, that makes a lot of sense in a mad way in terms of what, like, I'm kind of, I've got my face in my hat. I've got my face in my hand.
Oh yeah.
And yet I'm not totally surprised judging by what I know of you, because the idea, like, I know that you're close to your mum. I know had heard you're estranged from your dad.
Yeah.
But I also know that you're kind of like a kind of collager of pop culture. So the idea that you, like, your mum would go, and now Suze will read the printed email. That to me, it's not just the kind of the idea of you taking a found object and doing an emotional performance with it, but it also has a kind of clip art quality to it.
Totally. Well, and literally, like, that show, I always use a projector in my shows. And I would, like, I had projections of the bit of the email I was reading out, like a quote. I didn't read out the whole fucking thing, but I had the quote on the screen, and then just a photo of him in, like, doing various different facial expressions. And then I just read out that bit, and for some reason it worked. And like I say, I didn't expect anyone to come see it, because who was I? But people saw the Defying Gravity picture. The picture for the show was me in full Elphaba face painted green.
Yes.
And people come along for that. But then it was like, come for the musical theatre, stay for the insane email. And the amount of people afterwards who would go, oh, my mother was exactly the same. Oh, I never speak to my grandfather because that's what he did to my mom. And it was, it became like this thing where loads of people saw it and went, oh yeah, I'm estranged from a parent. And I didn't know that was a thing.
Yeah.
I didn't know I was estranged either. I was just like, oh yeah, I don't see my dad.
Okay.
Because it's better not to.
Okay.
So that's the first show.
So that, a tremendous amount to unpack there. if I can put my own stuff in quotes. So I suppose my first question is, when making that show, were you led by, like, what kind of artistic concerns did you have? Did, like, other than, I've got this and I'm going to do this, was it simply as a piece of, here's some found comedy, I'm putting some things together and I'm just operating by instinct? Like, with things like that, when I see things like that, I always think, this is, like, I love it when people do stuff like that. But part of me is thinking, how do you measure or correct or tweak or edit things like that when the basic path that you're following is this sense of, like, whatever it is I want to do is the thing?
Yeah, I don't know. I think I wasn't really aware of the whole idea of the Edinburgh debut. I also, this is 2014, and I also hadn't heard the cliche of the sad ending for a show. Mm-hmm. I just hadn't. I'd seen Bridget Christie's show the year before. That was in 2013. I thought it was really brilliant. And I remember thinking, oh, you can talk about anything in the show. But it didn't make me go, oh, you could talk about a real hard-hitting issue. Because I wasn't doing that. I was talking about my own story. And I thought it would be funny. Mm-hmm. That's literally it. You earlier said, oh, an emotional reading of the email. And I... I felt like I was doing a completely unemotional show, because if I'm really upset about something, I don't think I could do comedy about it.
Okay.
Like, I couldn't have done that show in 2011.
Yes, okay.
When it was all raw and happening.
Sure. And you also seem to have, I don't want to say stumbled, I don't want to kind of remove your kind of artistic agency, but you have hit upon that a thing which I feel like should be one of the golden rules of comedy, which is that if you make it really specific, it becomes relatable. And if you try to relate to everyone, it becomes bland. So by going super specific, you hit upon this thing, which I think really permeates all of your work. You know, your work couldn't be more specific to your life and the things you like. And as a result, that presumably plays a part in kind of gathering a following of people who kind of tag on to those sorts of concerns, right?
Yeah, and it's a weird one because it's people across all age ranges. I have, all genders, I have people who come back to the shows each year who are in their 50s, and there's no way, there's like, they didn't grow up playing Sonic, but they somehow relate to it. I don't know. Yeah. It's weird. But like you say, if you make it really specific, people will go like, oh, here's how I feel about that thing.
What was the best bit of that show? Do you remember like a particular line? I've not seen it, but like, do you remember a particular bit being like either you feeling, oh great, I get to do this bit next, or the bit that always killed?
So it came up by pure accident, because like I say, I didn't really know what I was doing. Like, I remember this brief tangent, but while I was up there, someone said to me, oh, it's your first year, you're lucky because you can just do your greatest hits. And I remember being like, oh, what? I could have done that. I could have just stitched some sets together. Fuck. There was one bit in the show there's one bit in the email. The email was written, this 7,500 word email. He'd written it all on his iPhone. There was some weird autocorrect thing going on, which meant that every time my name came up, which was 48 times in the email, it autocorrected from Susanna to Susanna Nana. And I told them that before I started reading the email. But in the first time I previewed it, I went, oh, P.S. This is a weird autocorrect thing. I don't know what happened. And they all really laughed. And then every time I would read out Susanna Nana.
Yeah.
And I'd do it in my impression of my dad's voice, which is exactly the same as my brother's impression of my dad's voice, it turns out. So it must be real. Every time I read that bit out, the audience would lose it. And I was like, oh, this, and that's me. That's not a brag. It's literally just how ridiculous.
Yes. Yeah. Okay. And what was, just before we move on from that show, what was was there kind of familial fallout for having done that, or had that ship already sailed? Like, you didn't know anything about?
My mum left him on New Year's Day 2011.
Okay.
And I was like, cool, I'm out too.
Sure.
That's done the job for me. I'm out now. So, okay. Yeah.
And did you have any reservations about kind of reading a letter that was intended for only one or two people to see? Like, were there any kind of... I'm not calling you a monster. What I'm asking is, did you have reservations at the time? Like, is it fair to do this?
No, I didn't think it was unfair, but I also didn't think anyone would see it.
Yeah.
I just figured this is not getting back to anyone. This is a tiny little show. Hence, I will not revisit the show. Gotcha. I wouldn't do it now when I know there's an audience.
Okay.
Not so much to not be fair on my dad, but just because I don't want to hear the discourse on it if there is any.
Yeah.
I can't be arsed with it. So now that people saw it, then I went, oh, okay. I'm now more careful about what I put in my shows.
Yes.
Whereas
yes.
then I wasn't at all, because I thought, no one's seeing this.
Yeah, we'll get on to that. Not in a foreboding way, but there's definitely stuff to talk about there. I said that in a really foreboding way.
Yes, we'll get on to that.
When we get...
I heard what you did.
When we get on to Reply Guys, we'll get on to that. So did it have, doing something that was kind of like such a, like you said, you were kind of over it. Did it still have any kind of, I don't know, if not catharsis, did it have... Did your mum see the show? How did your mum feel about the show?
My mum found, I think my mum found it a lot more cathartic than I did. Because it was.
Comedy is allowed
to
be therapy if it's on behalf of someone else.
Because I already knew it was all ridiculous. And my mum did as well. But when people are like, no way, then she's able to go, see, look, they all, it was very important to my mum that people thought, didn't think she was an issue.
Yeah. Okay.
And that's kind of like, it's kind of validation, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I didn't really need that. I've never particularly needed validation in people thinking my dad's wrong about me.
Yes.
Which is quite weird. However, if someone thinks he's correct and believes his, you know, the let's say untruths about me when they get back to me, yeah, that stings. But I think that would anyway, wouldn't it? If someone's lying, if like some old boss from 10 years ago lied about me, I'd still go, what?
Yes, so that has resonance in kind of like a way that isn't knitted to the kind of father-daughter element of it.
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And why do you think that is? Because that is presumably quite unusual that people... I mean, you said yourself that, you know, you don't feel kind of not invested exactly,
right.
But you might expect some people to wobble about that. I mean, Jesus, if you look at the amount of male comics who are writing, someone tweeted this, I can't credit it or take credit for it, but someone said, can you imagine the good that could be done for future comedy festivals if dads would just man up and look after their sons or something?
I mean, my God.
I'm butchering it, but you get the point.
No, it's so true. I heard this is from a comedian that I have no real affection for, but it's an American comic called Jay Moore, and it really stuck with me what he said. He said, we are the last generation of children who were not hugged by their fathers. And I said this to a friend of mine, my friend Gareth, who does a character called Myra Dubois. He went, oh, that's so good. And I've heard him use it as well. And it's so true. And I think that's why there's so many comedians sort of our sort of age.
Yeah.
Who do the crap dad show.
Yeah. But
I didn't know the crap dad show was a thing.
No, sure. But your crap dad show wasn't an example of the genre, was it? Because you weren't out doing an outpouring of your own emotion.
No.
So why is it to do with you and your, I mean, from what I know of you from Mega Drive, you were a kind of like an outsider to the usual girly gang kind of thing. The usual girly gang. This is welcome to my TED talk. But you know, from that anecdote you say, from that story about you going around your friend's house to play Duck Hunt, and the three boys then end up wrestling and playing wrestling games.
Yeah,
and
you're they still, play wrestling.
Yeah, sure. And you're still nailing Duck Hunt. And that does, so that goes kind of, I think the point of that story is it sets you aside from a kind of traditional, if there is such a thing as a traditional girl or a more usual kind of girl childhood.
Yeah, it's a weird one. I went to a very, very ordinary state school in a village, and there was, like, one of the mums started up an after-school ballet club, and I was the only girl in it. It was a girl in my class, and I was the only girl who didn't go to it.
Okay.
Not through choice. It just, my mum was like, not spending £3 a week on that. You're having a laugh. I never really gave it much thought until I went to drama school and went like, oh, it'd be so useful to have a grounding in dance at this point.
Yeah.
But there was never any wish to be a ballet girl, to wear a tutu and be a ballerina.
And how did you feel about that at the time? Did you feel anything about it? Did you notice that you were apart from the usual?
Yeah, I did. But yeah, I think, because I've got this thing where I always see myself as, I will put this in quotation marks because like on an academic level, I know it's not true, but I will always see myself as an ugly girl. So it was always fact, I'm the ugly girl in the class, and that's why I'm not friends with all the pretty girls. And I was kind of like, and that's fine because it means I get to do all these things that are fun. I wasn't okay with it, but I think that comes from society, man. They instill it in you. that girls are pretty and they're ballerinas and they're not noisy. And I was all those things, but I also made no effort to be anything else. I have never made any effort to be anything other than what I am. So,
yes. Yeah, well, that...
to my detriment, a lot of the time, I expect.
Well, I don't know. I don't think... Like, is it to your detriment? Because that is a more usual kind of stand-up origin story, which ends up with someone being a champion, doesn't it? Like, that is like, I never bothered doing anything other than being myself. That's someone...
Yeah.
That suggests you have a certain amount of kind of self-compassion. Like, there are some people who might be in that position, and I'm not taking a position here on whether or not you were the ugly girl, but if you felt like that at the time, there are some people who would let that crush them. And it doesn't seem to have done that. Like, to what extent were you upset by that? Or to what extent did you, like, how quickly did you make that connection of going, well, if I'm not that, that's fine, because I can do X, Y, Z. Is that something you've kind of retconned and gone, it must have been okay? Or were you at the time thinking, this isn't so bad?
I think I've always, and I thought it then, other people have more of a problem with this than I do.
Yeah, right.
And sometimes I have a problem with it, obviously. But I think it's always been a thing where, because like I discovered how to put on makeup about 6 years ago. That's how, when I discovered how to really do your makeup. Obviously, okay. I could always put lots of black eyeliner on and go, my makeup is done. And I went, and it was such a revelation because it's not hard. And then you can make yourself look like anything, which is really useful if you're working in cabaret and going on a big night out, like anything like that. And I found being able to do your makeup really well extremely freeing. However, it's never led me down a path of, well, I'm going to Tesco, I better put on a full face of makeup. Sure. Like, we're on Zoom now, I don't need to put on a face of makeup to go on Zoom. So, yeah, I like speaking to all the girls who, and I'm not going to say to all the ugly girls, but all the girls who feel like you're an ugly girl, like it gets to a point where you go, oh, it really doesn't matter. It might matter to someone else, but it really doesn't matter. And hypocrite, even though quite often I go, well, the reason I'm not in TV and film is because I'm an ugly girl.
Ah, okay. That's an interesting, I mean, I'm also kind of zooming out from that and going, oh, you wouldn't let yourself have a positive moment there. But like, you were saying a lovely thing to other people and you actually just stepped back from it and said, but here's a reason I'm a chump, you know. Yeah, okay.
Sorry, it's all very raw because I just watched the Meghan Markle interview. I'm like, your dad's an asshole.
Yeah, right. Okay. Yeah. Oh, sure. So... but do you fall back on that? Do you let you're over the fact that you are, and I'll use your inverted commas as well, you know, an ugly girl, fine.
Right.
But you're over that, and yet you do kind of fall back on it in moments of any comedian's weakness. Why am I not on that? Why have I not got further with this? That is what Felicity Ward would call Old Faithful, which is the stick that you pick up to beat yourself with.
God, it's so good. Yeah.
Jeez.
Yeah, absolutely do that.
So this is Suze, and it's just a great joy to talk to her. And I'm so in awe of her resilience, really, and her kind of toughness, her intestinal fortitude, as Henry Rollins would have it, the very funny way that she uses Twitter. I highly recommend following her at Suze UK, S-O-O-Z-U-K, at Suze UK. And she's also, we didn't really talk about these, but she's the co-host of the Queen podcast and the co-host of the Mystery on the Rocks podcast, which is excellent as well. You can also find her streaming, I'm going to say constantly, at twitch.tv/SuzeKempner. So plenty more stuff coming up with Suze in just a second, but do go to comedianscomedian.com/insiders for all of the extras, including me wrestling with the fact that she is Luke Kempner's sister. And I don't think I knew that. It's one of those ones where you go, it seemed equally mad that she be Luke Kempner's sister and he her brother, and that not to be the case. So Luke Kempner, very funny comic and impressionist, and we will talk. Suze is very frank about her the struggle, really. Let's not say struggle, let's say challenge. The challenge of having a brother who she perceives at least to be more kind of mainstream successful than she is. She's very open about that. And we'll also learn about how she deals with her internal mean girl. All of those on the extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. Also, the audio of the exclusive Insiders Q&A Zooms with James Acaster and the forthcoming audio of the Nish Kumar one, which was excellent last week, but I'm not going to release it for just probably 2 weeks or so whilst we let all the faff die down. So a bit of that available there. And more of this. I don't think I have anything to spruik to you. I mean, there's all the usual at stuartgoldsmith.co.uk. But other than that, let's get back to Suze Kempner.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I really enjoyed that little walk through your first hour. Take us to the next one and what changed and what you learnt in between.
Okay, next hour was... I decided I'd been doing these characters on YouTube since before my first show. So in 2013, I started doing these characters where I was a really posh it girl called Felidia, or I was a Scientologist vlogger called Pixie. There were a few of them, and there was like an Essex girl who's got real interest in politics, and her whole thing is she isn't dumb at all, but she comes from that very glitzy only way is Essex. That was her circle, but okay. She's actually really interested in politics. So I was doing all these videos, and I went, well, rather than write a whole new hour next year, I'll just do my characters, because then you only have to write an hour for four characters, which is like way harder. So I took that, and it did well. It's all relative, obviously, but there was some industry came along and audiences liked it, and then I got this comedy agent who said, and I sent him a video of my first show, the Defying Gravity show. I said, I don't really know what to do for next year. He said, you could do both. And it was such a huge mistake. So okay. 2016 was my annus horribilis. I took up and self-produced and had to pay for two shows, a stand-up show and a character show.
Oh.
And I couldn't get, I got hardly any audience for either of them.
Oh, man.
And I just had, and neither of them were bad shows. I couldn't even say like, and the shows really suffered, because I think they were fine for like a quote, you know, show 3A and show 3B.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just horrible. It was horrible. And that's the only time I thought I shouldn't be doing comedy. I should just quit.
How do you keep going in that? Because I, you know, we've all kind of stood nervously outside the door and thought, oh, maybe I'll have to can it. You know, we've all had that moment.
There were several. It was a relief when it was that, and I didn't have to do it to three people. Yeah.
Oh, jeez. How do you? What sorts of things? What was your kind of self narrative during that horrible time? Like, did you have a kind of? Like, why didn't you, here's another way of asking the question, why didn't you pull everything and run away? What kept you in the game?
Because then you pulled everything and ran away. That's why it was a relief when no one turned up, because I was like, no control over that, have I?
Yeah, okay. Is there a sort of sense whereby, like, I'm wondering, I don't know if I could answer the question, I like, mm-hmm. when it's been really tough, in the past, I hasten to advertise to anyone listening
now,
we're both huge deals. but those moments, I suppose what I've said to myself is like, okay, I've just got to change the way I view this from being the triumph I thought it was to, oh, this is some more hard yards. This is me punching meat in Rocky. That kind of, like, to try and reframe it as, oh, okay, then it's there's a Jackie Chan quote. I think it's from Meals on Wheels. He's about to fight Benny the Jet Urquidez. And he has this, you can hear his in a monologue, and he's going, relax, think of it like training. It's like there's that. You sort of go into montage mode.
Yeah. There's a bit in Knock Down the House, brilliant documentary about a group of progressive women who are trying to win Democratic Congress primaries and seats in Congress. It's on Netflix. Brilliant. And AOC has to, so she primaried like a long-standing New York congressman, and she had to do a TV debate with him. And he had been, you know, smack talking about her before the debate, saying, oh, this is not a problem. And she's terrified. And just before the debate, she's sitting there with her eyes closed, and she says, you can do this. You're so prepared for this. This is the amount of space I want to take up. And I went, oh, that's what I was doing before my shows in 2016. Edinburgh, I'd be there going, you can absolutely do this, and it's not your fault. No one's here. Yeah. And it's not your fault if three people sit in this damp cave and are embarrassed and don't want to enjoy it. So it wasn't enough to not make me feel like a giant piece of shit up there that year, but it's so useful. I wonder how many women are doing that in spaces where they feel like when the thought comes in, you go, well, you're just not meant to be here.
Yeah.
It does help to go like, yeah.
Were you saying, just on a technical point, were you saying that stuff out loud to yourself in a room? Were you thinking it, or were you doing like actual out loud self talk? Okay.
Yeah. Corner of the stage, we like got a bit of fabric and pinned it to the two bits on the ceiling and two bits on the floor, and I could crawl behind there to do my character changes in the dark.
Fringe. We're fringing hard.
Yeah, it was so disgusting. It's like my lungs are full of spores.
Yeah.
And I would be behind there with the entrance music playing. But I'd put my fingers in my ears so I didn't have to hear the audience come in, because the whispers of five people, you know.
Yeah, sure.
And I would just be thinking to myself, it's all right, it's 55 minutes and it's done, and you go home. And then you don't have to do it for 24 hours.
How much of who you are today was in the you that you were at that point? Like the Suze Kemper, I refuse to refer to it as a brand, but the you, the persona, the Suze. There's something you tweeted recently. It was about the Meghan Markle thing. It was next to a meme, and you said, how many people are looking at this and thinking this is just Suze doing a bit? And that really made me laugh, because to me that speaks to a really coherent idea about you and who you are and what you offer. So how much of that Suze was present in that tougher time?
Probably more than I realized at the time. It was so horrible, and I'm not going to say like it was the worst month of my life, because it 1000% was not, but all the awful personal things that had happened to me in my life were all there in that month. So I think now, when I feel like absolute, you know, the lowest about my career, I go like, oh yeah, 2016, and it's better because it was actually fine.
Yeah.
No one died. I didn't lose a limb. I cried a lot and got really bad face eczema. But I, like, ultimately nothing bad happened.
Okay. Okay.
I paid all the money back, and now I'm all right. So
I paid.
It's
all
just
the
a career
money
thing.
Back.
It's just a career thing.
Oh,
yeah.
Man. So what? Okay. So regrouping. What was happening in your life after that? In the spot between that, in the year between that and the next Edinburgh, what was going on? Were you still with the same agent?
Dropped the agent because he told me not to go back to Edinburgh, and it wasn't some big deal, like, goodbye. But I just went, you know what? I will just do this without an agent for a bit, because it's stressing me out. It's stressing me out to feel like I'm letting somebody else down. And that's what I felt. So It was like a weight lifted to like, oh, now I can only let myself down. So, yeah, I then decided you don't have to do two shows to do characters and stand up. So I did the stand up show. My 2017 show, I wanted to do about films because I love cinema. I love Scorsese. I've got a big poster of Taxi Driver behind me. And I wanted to do how I got into cinema when I was 15. And then I could have the characters call me up on Skype. Okay. And then I'd interact with a video of my various characters. But then the last character, this is when I'd got a bit more savvy about Edinburgh at this point. The last character was, it was me in a wig and an Adidas top, but that's me at 15 going, what's going to happen? What's going to, and yeah. And there was a whole, I guess I did do a sad ending to that show. Because it was the time I discovered film was just after I turned 16. Basically, something awful happened, and that it was all ties into that, and I was able to tie that all in the show. But you then know when to, you don't reveal that at the beginning, you reveal it at the end. Mm-hmm. And then we sang a duet together.
That's nice.
Of This Woman's Work by Kate Bush.
And in the, like you say, you were more savvy in kind of putting that together. You've got a bit more nouse about how, you know, what one might do to stand the best chance of being noticed. In terms of putting the actual stuff together, when it comes to kind of writing the scripts and writing for the characters, my notion, I suppose, that for the characters is that you put on the gear and you improvise and then save the best bits. Or is that, are you actually more kind of routine than that? Do you sort of sit and write, and like what does that look like for you?
It's actually very written, and it's only in lockdown that I've started improvising as a character on
you
saved Twitch.
Me there, because I was about to have to say, well, my notion was completely wrong. My notion is based on lockdown. Okay, fine.
Yeah, no, that's what I've done in lockdown, and it's so good, and I was like, oh shit, I should have been doing this for years. But no, before that, prior to that, it was very written.
Okay.
And
what was the process for writing those kind of stuff? Like, give us an example, like when you're obviously, maybe not when you're writing your 15-year-old self, because one would imagine that you've got a wealth of experience to draw on.
Yeah.
But for some of the characters, were the characters still those sorts of characters you described before, like the sort of the political Essex girl, those kind of notions, like clashes between ideas?
Yeah, it was exactly that. I mean, so my mum is a professional dressage rider for a job, and but we're not from money, and dressage is a very moneyed sport. So my mum's a bit of an anomaly within the in the dressage industry, I guess you could call it. But, you know, she's carved out a path for herself within that and done very well in it. But that has meant that growing up, I've mixed with incredibly wealthy people. Which I guess has made, I think I'm from like a family of outsiders, if you want to put it that way. Like, my mum's an outsider in her sport, and I was just carted around with her the whole time as a kid, because there was no, you know, ain't no nanny.
Yeah, right.
So you just mix with children who are in educations that each education costs in a year what my mum makes in a year doing her job. Yeah, I don't even know where I'm going with this.
No, no, but that's interesting. I mean, the idea of a family of outsiders is quite unusual. Often the comic, you start from being an outsider, definitely.
Mm-hmm.
But to be an outsider of a family of outsiders, that's quite an interesting sort of thought. Meeting those other kids, did you feel, again, did your outsiderness kind of manifest as I'm inferior to you, or I'm apart from you, or I'm in a different game to you?
Yeah. But it always came back to looks.
Really?
I think that's a really odd thing.
You can afford a face.
You can afford to look lovely, can't you? Weird one. I knew that they were at private school and I wasn't. But it came back to like, oh yeah, I'm that ugly girl who goes there on a weekend.
Oh, man.
Thing is, we'd all play together, and a lot of them would have nice ponies, and I got to ride around on them. So It's a weird one. You got on.
Looking back at it now as an adult, do you think that they regarded you as the ugly girl, or was that entirely in your head? Was that just like a kind of...
Probably.
Do you think?
I don't know. I'm getting better as I get older as of not judging everyone by my own standards. But I would never I'd never meet someone and judge them on their looks. That's so weird. You don't really notice that if someone is...
Yeah.
Quote unquote, like, what even is ugly? Like, what is it? But like, I wouldn't notice it, someone, but I don't know. Maybe they do. Maybe they go face this, face that, that bit of the face like that. I don't know. I think it's really weird.
No, I mean, for sure. But I suppose, I mean, less to do with the actual kind of physicality of any person's face, whether you were behaving as if you'd sort of accepted, oh, I guess I'm the ugly girl here again.
Yeah,
as
yeah.
well, whether that had any basis in reality, or whether it was based whether it had any basis in the reality of their behavior, or whether it was based on your feelings of being an outsider and therefore...
Oh yeah, it's probably based on my feelings of being outsider. I mean, don't get me wrong, like, kids did bully me for the way I looked, but that, again, that's kids. They do that.
Yeah.
They couldn't bully me for being fat, because I was always like a little bean sprout. So,
but that doesn't that suggest that they would that it was inevitable that they would want to bully you?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
still I that's my experience on Twitter. But now I get like a strange sense of like, I'm 36 now. Come at me, no marks.
Well, yeah. I mean, so let's talk about this for a little bit, because you are.
Sorry, this is all meant to be about the comedy process.
No,
isn't
no,
it?
No.
And
no,
all
no,
I've
no.
done is go, I just watched Meghan Markle.
No. This is prime ComCom. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
So you are one of the most, and I think that's what first made me kind of notice you as a comic in some ways.
Uh-huh.
Your amazing resilience at dealing with, like, I've seen the way, you know, you'll get aggro from someone on Twitter, or not even aggro, like the reply guy phenomenon, and we'll get to that in just a sec. But, and then kind of almost like sneak over to Facebook and go, hey, actual friends, look at these dicks. And you
screen grab some dick.
Yeah. So screen grabbing a thing whereby you've made a joke, someone has misunderstood it, tried to top it clumsily, or simply replied to it blandly in a way that kind of just creates, you know, a barnacle. It just creates drag on the joke without offering anything. And you are so, and it's almost like you're not simply going onto Facebook and going, look at this twat. You're often going, hey, everyone, would you like to celebrate with me how well I dealt with it? Because you are. Not in a way that's obnoxious at all. Not at all. But I just think that's really like, I mean, I don't say boo to a goose on any social media, because the idea of the conflict just screws me up inside. I'm like, how I literally will. I've got the Facebook group associated with this podcast. And I was about to say traps off. That's an old Levington expression from my friend Spencer Cummings. Whenever anyone traps off in there, I literally lose sleep. I can't cope with the conflict. So you're just my hero in terms of how you kind of go, here's a joke. Someone does a thing. You're like, shut it. Oh, do you know what I mean? You come back to it.
Yeah. Oh God. Now it's all part of this conversation. I think it really comes back to the fact that I'm like, no, you can't anymore. You could try and do that thing that I've known it. I knew that way before you were even invented. I think it comes back to that.
Yeah.
And I know it's very Alan Partridge. Needless to say, I had the last laugh. But posting some guy who's like, I think I've got her here. And it's, you know, some asshole going, call yourself a feminist, but I can't help but notice you're wearing a dress in this picture. How interesting. You're like, oh, mate, you did not want to dip your toe in this pool, because I've been dealing with you since I could talk, since I turned round to my dad at 18 months old and inadvertently embarrassed him. Like, I've already dealt with you, so this is not a problem. But I do like celebrating it on Facebook.
Is there, and I am by no means qualified at anything. The fact that your go-to example there was your dad, and without I'm not pressing at the nature of that, you know what I mean? Like I don't mean to kind of get into that if you don't want to. But the fact that the most common reply guy is an older man, is there something there?
Absolutely. Yeah, he was my first reply guy.
So let's
before we get into that,
let's just flesh this out, because I remember, in fact, sure. I remember I was so enjoyed. Do you remember I must have texted you like a year ago and I was like, Suze, idea for a movie. You've got to write a horror movie about reply guys, which I notice you haven't done it yet, despite doing everything
I'm
else.
On it.
So can you get
I'm on
that?
It.
but that totally came from your, like, I hadn't come up with the concept of a reply guy. Is that yours? Right. Is it a thing? I don't even know what it is.
There was an article on it. I think there are people who think I coined the phrase. I saw an article on reply guys, but it was just more general. It's like, they're not trolls. They're just reply guys. They're just guys who are just replying all day when a like or retweet would suffice. Yes. And so I was like, oh, that's so good, reply guys. But yeah, I categorized them.
Yeah.
Because I'd seen every type.
Okay. And is when you categorize them, is that one of your, like when you do, I don't know, how buses would have reacted to Brexit, you know, which you do these brilliant kind of, I don't want to call them listicles, but it's almost like a listicle format for some absurd comedy.
It's really stupid. Yeah.
So have you done one of those about the categories of reply guy?
I haven't actually. I did like how the quality streets voted in the EU referendum and how the, if it's really funny because you'd do it, you'd be like the purple one signed two petitions, felt really good about it for the next 6 months. And like people will write scarily accurate. No, it's about sweet. It's about...
So
that's that. But no, the reply guys, I did like, I've got a lot of experience with reply guys. Here's all the types. Okay. And I did an example because I'd done a tweet. Oh, God, it's so long-winded. Sorry. I did a tweet that was like something to do with people who won't wear a mask, but it was men who won't wear a mask willingly wore bootcut jeans and pointy brown leather shoes in 2003. I think I wrote something like that. And I got so many. I got every category of reply guy underneath from like... personally offended reply guy who's got 28 followers who assumed I was directly attacking him. So he's personally offended reply guy. There's righteous reply guy who's like attacking others for the way they dressed. The so-called tolerant left. Yeah. That's righteous reply guy. And he's a much better person than you. There's not funny reply guy who tells you you're not funny.
Okay.
You are not funny. And I need, so it's just all the different categories of reply guy, and that went nuts. That, and that still comes up, like it'll come up in my Twitter mentions, someone replying to a reply guy by using my tweet about that category, and I'm like,
public service.
Yeah.
That's like tagging white nonsense, do you know what I mean? That's one of those things, like
yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So with that in mind, we've established what a reply guy is, and mm-hmm. Do you wonder whether you deliberately provoke them? Not in the sense of, obviously we've established, you know what I mean? I don't think that, of course people shouldn't be giving each other grief on the internet. But there are, like do you enjoy, I feel like you provoke them and I feel like it's because you enjoy it. Not to suggest you don't have the absolute right to put your stuff out there without shit on it. But given that you know what presses their buttons, do you ever find yourself baiting them?
No, but I do tweet stuff knowing full well the reaction I'll get. So I only want to appeal to the what I would call the audience I want to appeal to.
Yeah.
Like that's who I want to appeal to. It's always annoying to get a reply guy. I the reason I'm sharing the screen grabs then on my private Facebook for people to go, wah, at, is not because I'm like, yes, I caught one. People will reply with like a gif of someone fishing and I go like, no, you don't understand. Okay. I don't want them there. I want them to leave me alone. However, I guess I built a thing now. I'd honestly rather, because I get, there'll be occasionally like massive flurries of abuse from what I've coined Flag Twitter.
Yes. Was that your coinage? I started
using Flag Twitter. And that's guys who are called like Mike 0192386, and they've got a Union Jack in their Twitter name or a St. George's Cross. And they hate me the most. And when they come for me, they can get really abusive. But that I find almost validating, because I'm like, oh, I've pissed these guys off. I don't want them as an audience. So when they tell me I'm not funny and I'm sat there like so calm, I go, oh, they don't know how they're the only one who's angry here. Whereas if I've got some reply guy going, oh, didn't you mean?
Yeah.
I think you actually mean. I'm like, no, now I'm annoyed.
Yes. Oh, I see. So that kind of, it's like the limp handshake of a reply guy.
Yes.
A reply guy reply. That's it.
You'd rather they high-fived you too hard.
Yes, yeah. Right. Okay. Yeah. Well put. Okay.
You're like, my hand. You'd rather that.
So with Twitter, how did you get, I know you were an early-ish adopter of YouTube.
Yeah.
And you were you an early adopter of Twitter as well? Because you...
Yeah.
I'll just chuck this in. This isn't sort of really technically part of the question. But I noticed, I don't know if you know, is it Vittorio Angelo? I want to say it's Vittorio Angelo.
Vittorio Angelo.
And tweets at that Vittorio. And he's, I'll have to tidy this up if I fucked up one or either of his names. But he's a comic and he tweeted something. He did a Meghan Markle Oprah interview caption.
Yeah.
And of which there are many. His was a good, it was a good one, apparently. I didn't understand it. I think it was about football. But, but he tweeted this morning a screen grab of the stats that Twitter give you, whereby something like 1.5 million people interacted with this or saw it or something. And then all the way down the stats, new follows, 4.
Yes.
And I kind of went, oh, wow, is that how it's always been? I'll ask Suze. So talk me through you joining Twitter and how it kind of became explosive for you, how you cultivated your audience.
Sure.
with one eye on the stats of how that works, because Christ, I don't know.
Yeah. So with Twitter, as with apparently everything else I do, I am just there going, I will aggressively be myself and see if people like it. If they don't like it, hopefully they'll just stay off it. So I spent 10 years on Twitter. I joined in 2009. And in that time, I got 5,000 followers, which is not to be sniffed at. I was like, cool, 5,000 followers. Then I went really viral with a thread I did about working as a Christina Aguilera tribute.
Yes. Okay. I can't remember whether I saw the original thread or if I've seen references to it since and then gone back to it. But I certainly,
okay,
it's viral enough that I know exactly what you're talking about. Yeah.
Yeah. That was in end of May 2019. Okay. 2019, and it went I had never had anything go viral to that degree, and I gained 20,000 new followers in like 2.5-3 days. It was insane, and it got retweeted by Piers Morgan. He liked it unironically. Gutted, mate.
and do you know why that story, do you have a kind of notion as to why that story went explosive when other stuff happened?
Absolutely no idea still. I mean, it's wacky and weird and I guess, but I didn't plan it out. I talked about being Christina Aguilera tribute in my comedy. Like, it was part of some of my first stand-up, because it's sort of tailor-made for it, isn't it? I wrote about 5 tweets going, oh, yeah, that happened one day, and being a tribute act, that happened, thinking there's 15 likes.
Okay.
And it just went berserk almost immediately.
Is that because it was true? Was it truer than, like, your in terms of the context of your output up until that point, had you been doing long true stories?
Yeah.
Okay.
Without even realizing it. As soon as you could do a thread on Twitter, I was, you break up your tweets. And
or it was something, just from what I remember of it, did the story have the whiff of danger to it somehow?
Oh,
it had a kind of hint of trafficking, something like that.
It was actually really mundane. I think the tribute act company was a bit of a tax dodge for a very minor bit of organised crime in Iron Upper. But you can, people will turn that into Goodfellas in their head, even though I wasn't putting on there. I thought I would die, because I never did.
Yeah, okay.
I think there is an element of that. I mean, it's so weird, I guess. this is me deconstructing it after the fact. I guess it's such an odd thing to read. Yeah, it was a Christina Aguilera tribute act in Cyprus. It was a tax dodge for the Cypriot mafia. I guess that's so odd that people went, what?
Yes,
and that
sure.
got me new followers because it was about me okay. rather than just like a meme that goes viral and yes. you might get a couple of hundred extra.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, tough luck, Vittorio Angeloni, as I now, having checked, know your surname is. Apologies for getting that wrong. yeah, okay. So that big leap in 20,000, and then that presumably, did you then try to recreate those conditions in order to continue to grow the following?
Yeah, I guess once I saw that if you write something in a thread format and you open it with, here's, with almost like a title, like, here's the worst, I've done like, here's the worst experience I've ever had at the cinema, and then people go like, oh, it's Suze Kempner, so it'll be something crazy. Then yeah, just you always tell the truth.
And is there something, I'm just, apologies if I sound like a robot here, but is there something about the fact that you're, if you preface it without revealing it in the first tweet, it makes people click on the second tweet, and then that stimulates the algo somehow or something like that? Okay,
yeah, I think so, yeah. And people go like, you write the first one. It got to the point after about 6 months of doing these threads about various different things, you'd write the first one and then people would go, oh my God, I've made myself a cup of tea. I can't wait. Like,
no, that's absolutely right. I remember, like, I've had that experience of going like, oop, here's a Suze thread. Like, you've sort of, you've really kind of, I don't know what, you've kind of stuck a little flag into that and gone, this is a that's thing it. That I do well. You know, great.
Yeah, I guess so. Yeah. And it don't know if help with stand-up because it's the same, like, instant feedback. You know, like, if a thread is getting... You know, if the first tweet in a thread is on a thousand retweets, you go, oh, there's something here, and you can build a stand-up routine sure. around it. So it's been useful.
Again, my robot mind is going, so what you want to do is say, here's a thread on, and then some random subjects. Like, just do 1,000 of them at random, and whichever one gets the biggest retweets, you think, then you go back and write the actual thread going, well, it's worth filling in some sort of story for this.
Right.
If there's any bots listening, that's what you should do.
That's what they should be doing. Stop just going around. So if your bio on Twitter says Trump 2020 and you're in America, I'm going to know you're a bot if you're coming for me because I made fun of Jim Davidson.
Yeah. So, well, let's just talk then about bots and trolls and how they, because that's obviously quite separate to reply guys. Like, you're sufficiently adept at Twitter now that you can, that you kind of, you attract those kind of negative attention.
Yeah.
I mean, let's imagine, Suze, that I know nothing about how bots actually work beyond some concept that they're not physically robots.
Yes.
So what do you notice? What gives you the whiff of a bot, and why do you think they would respond to what you're doing?
It's like a bot, for those who don't know, as this is my understanding of it, there are people who are paid to create multiple fake accounts to spread disinformation or to drive the discourse in a certain direction. I believe that's what it is.
Yeah, that's,
so
that
but
sounds,
people think it's people think it's robots being run through a computer. That, like, ignore them, it's just a bot, you're not talking to anyone, like, actually it's still a person. So there'll be just a stock image and you can tell it'll be a name with a bunch of numbers. They haven't normally got shut down because they're only weeks old, the account. You look on the account, you're like, oh, it was created last month.
Okay.
And they'll tend to reply with something that has nothing to do with what you were talking, or limited to, they're not really replying to your tweet. They're just saying something general and awful in the hope that there'll be a lot of replies. And unfortunately, people bite.
Yes. Yes.
And I mean, then that perpetuates it.
I mean, I don't know that they are. It strikes me that they needn't all be actual humans. Presumably, they could be. They could be literal chatbots. Like, they spot a word.
Oh yeah.
And like when you did Trump, but it's Liza Minnelli.
Yeah.
You know, that presumably they, somewhere down the line, something.
Yeah.
Some, you get flagged as, this person did a thing about Trump and has more than 20,000 followers, and so we should.
Yes.
Yeah, okay.
That was the reaction to not wishing to intellectualise me dressing up as Liza Minnelli and
this
delivering
is the place
Trump
to do
speeches. Delivering Trump speeches verbatim, because that wasn't the purpose. But all I'm doing is delivering Trump's actual words with a sort of accurate impression of Liza Minnelli. That's all I'm doing. The way people who support Trump took it was very interesting, because they would go, you can cry about Trump as much as you like. He's still going to win in November. And like, what bit of that was me crying about Trump? Those are his actual words. So that's you essentially admitting that that what he says is horseshit. If you're then going, yeah, you can attack him if you want. And it's like, I didn't. I said his actual words, didn't change a word.
Wait, I've got another boring technical question about Twitter okay. and YouTube and the relationship between them. But before I get to it, yeah. something that strikes me is your glee at being badly heckled. Do you know what I mean? Like heckled not to a standard. And the yeah. way that you can, you know, you sort of frame that experience for yourself not as an attack, the sort of thing that I would be like, oh God, someone I'm going to meet is going to go at me. Yeah. You frame that as, this is great, I'm hungry for it, and I'm kind yes. of... I'm experiencing pleasure from it. You know, you've got like, yeah. like the reply guys is more annoying, but this is just yes. proof I'm annoying the right people.
When it's flag Twitter and you've like called out some racism and they go, you're a racist. I'm like, oh, you got me. Like, yeah, it's the idea of they've gone like, I can get her here.
Yes.
You got it a lot when they pulled that statue of Colston, who's an ex because he's dead, but he was a slave trader.
Yeah.
They pulled him into the river, and I tweeted, oh, there were probably lots of people in this country who learnt way more about the British slave trade from this happening than they ever did at school. And the replies were insane, but they're like, that they all say, I'm sure you've had it yourself, but they say things like, you're meant to be a comedian, that wasn't funny at all.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you got me.
Yeah.
So it's that idea of like, I like it when they fail at owning me, because they're the only ones who end up getting upset. I think that's what it is.
Okay, so that's precisely that. When you say you like that, is that like, is that, to what extent have you had to kind of contrive that kind of happiness at a shitty attack? As a defense mechanism for putting up with shitty attacks. Like, presumably, your life would be better if that just never happened.
Oh, yeah, I guess, yeah, yeah. When it's not personal, it's all right. It's amazing. And I guess I've had to turn this around. So, like, flag Twitter. If they want to come for me over something I've said that's political, they will very often attack the way I look. And I've had to... I have had to make that a thing where I go, and oh no, I was going to fall in love with them, and now they've scuppered my chances. I will never be able to have sex with this racist.
Yeah, now. Sure.
You know, you have to turn into that. But like, it's all right if it's one or two. But I had a weekend of it last month when a load of Michael Jackson fanatics came for me, and they were, I mean, that's some of the worst abuse I've had about my looks. Ever. It was crazy, and it went on for 72 hours. Now, you don't interact with them, you mute them immediately. Don't block them, because they love to get blocked, because they're like, she blocked me, see? Mute them, they don't know. But the problem is, you then see all the replies from other people going, leave her alone, looks aren't everything. You're like, oh,
yeah, she's not actually a direct quote of thing. Yeah, right.
So yeah, that did get to me, but you just make sure you never let them know it did.
Yeah.
I think it did occur
to me, like, I don't know the extent to which people will do research in order to attack someone, but if you want me to paywall that we're talking about that, that's fine, because I would hate for people to listen to this and go, that's the weak point, you know?
That is. Yeah, tell me you saw my most recent ex with a girl who looked like me, but just so much better looking.
Oh my God.
Just that's how they could get to me. But they don't really.
This is
that.
Mission Impossible just... now. I reveal that the whole interview has been about trying to work out the single tactical weakness in your armor.
It's like, turns out Stu Goldsmith's a really bad guy. Look at all these tweets I'm getting from him now. He's... And I'm like,
yeah. I don't know, man. Obviously, it is. It's kind of a delight for me in some ways, seeing you kick back against all these pricks. But at the same time, there is a part of me that's like, wouldn't it be great if you didn't need to develop a joy?
I think I sound a little bit probably like I've contradicted myself a lot during this, because I'm like, I don't care. And then that made me sad. But it's things like that. It's when I never had that at school or growing up, someone going like, I love the way that they think you don't care. I love the way that you, I love the way that you own those assholes over this. I think it's that. I think it's like, haha, I own these pricks now.
Yeah. Yeah.
So, yeah.
And do you manage to maintain that aspect of your kind of armor, even when you are like with whatever struggles there are, whether they be creative struggles or kind of down moments? Does that core come down with you, or are you like, I'm depressed despite how fun it is to own these assholes?
I can't think of a time in lockdown that I've been like, I feel really depressed because none of this is, you know, coronavirus isn't personal. The worst I felt was when I actually had it. I'm only thinking of the last year, obviously, but yeah, I can't think of them. They hadn't actually got me down, even if there were things I'm like, oh God, I'm an ugly girl.
I'm pleased to hear that. It does seem like you've got a specific, not a weakness, but there is a specific thing you think. There's like a core value you have, which is can be negative against yourself. People seize on it and you still are able to brush it off. And that's incredibly impressive.
I guess. Yeah. I don't know. I'm sure it would be a field day for a psychological expert, whatever they are.
Absolutely not that guy. I really enjoyed you described yourself as a sort of Asda Kate Bush. And that's kind of, I suppose, when I mentioned clip art earlier on, there is a certain, I quite enjoy the way you embrace your, like your green screen stuff being, I don't mean that it's crap, but nor are you aiming for high production values and failing.
No, this is because, like, have you seen Alistair Beckett King's stuff? It's amazing.
Yes.
It looks like Hollywood movies. Yeah. And I mean, I wouldn't really know where to start with that, but I know that YouTube tells you everything. So I could learn how to light my green screen and make it all look like that. And I went, I'm not going to do that. These are Sue's videos. Yeah. So, you put a big, big light on it so everything's very bright, and then hopefully no bits of the screen are blurry.
Yes.
End.
Yes. But there's something that really is in step with your kind of persona, I suppose, not having spent a load of money on it. Do you know what I mean? Like, it makes sense that you're like, no, this is part of the glee is in sticking things together that don't quite fit. Do you know what I mean?
Yes. If it, janky.
Yeah, janky. Thank you.
Yeah.
Yeah. But an Asda Kate Bush, that's not really a question. I just quite like the idea of an Asda Kate Bush. Is that when you coin that for yourself, does that help you, or did that help you kind of clarify what it is you're doing? There are certain things I feel like as comics, we kind of go, big one for me, and it's not anything I've used on stage really, but Tom Tuck told me on a car journey years ago with Carly Smallman, he said, well, you're a dad with no kids, aren't you? And I was like, oh God, yeah, I am. Yeah. You know what I mean? Like, now I'm a dad with kids. But at the time I was like, oh God, that is, you've got me there. And that's so useful to know. Like, there was something that just kind of, Carly laughed and I kind of laughed. I laughed, panicked, you know, and I sort of went, I'm having a reaction. That means it must be
he
true.
He saw me.
I guess that's it. Yeah. So do you like, so what other things is Suze Kempner besides an Asda Kate Bush? What other things have you or other people coined that you've gone, that's part of it?
Like the idea of being an adult baby. I'm just and not in like the comedy way. I see it less with women in comedy, more with men in comedy. Gráinne Maguire, who's brilliant, Gráinne Maguire said, she said, there's just so many men in comedy who are our age, aren't there, Suze, who go on stage and go, I'm just a boy. That was the word of it. It's so good. And I went, yeah, thinking, oh, shit, that's what I do. But it's because it's true. Like, I show up on time to things and I have a driving license and I have a car and can arrive at things like an adult would. At the heart of it, I want to be silly. I want to play all the time.
Yes. Yes. And I think, well, that's those two qualities, playfulness and a kind of naivety, they often go hand in hand with the idea of a comedian, don't they? Of going like, I don't fit in. Ooh, I don't belong here. Mm-hmm. And I don't understand it. And here I am misunderstanding it.
Yes.
So in defense of, I mean, I sometimes feel like, oh, what is this? You know?
Yeah. What am I even doing? I mean, I'm still in my mum's house because I'm doing the adult thing of not moving out and paying a grand a month in rent in London.
Yeah.
So that's adult, but it also you're a fucking child because you're 36 in your mum's house.
Are you staying in your? It wasn't your childhood house, was it? No,
no,
okay,
it wasn't. No, because the luckily because of the divorce, I can go. No, please, this is a grown up house for grown ups. Right. And just to my left, I have a Sonic duvet set. So
talk to me about that. Just while we're on the differences between men and women, but you know, as it pertains to comedians, and that, I mean, I'm really struck by that idea of you. I'm not suggesting there's no such thing as gamer girls at all, but you know, the way in which you have embraced kind of gaming, and I think at the time that seemed to come hand in hand with you feeling, and I'm quoting you from Mega Drive here, but feeling weird and boring. Do you mean you felt as a kid like I'm weird and boring, and geeky and I'm a girl doing things that the boys do normally. I suppose I'm not quite sure what the question is so much as kind of to what extent is your comedy perpetuating that or allowing you to think of it differently?
It's weird. I would never like tag myself, I'm a gamer girl, because I feel like I talk about video games way more than I play them.
Yes.
I'll talk about the...
Oh, because for you it's nostalgia, isn't it?
Yeah, I haven't played a modern video game. I haven't played a video game that came out after like 2000.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because I always say it's because they're 3D and I've got no sense of direction because it's true. Like, it's true. I started playing games on the PlayStation. I played Tomb Raider. I'm like, well, I could kind of find my way around our house, but I don't know how to get through these catacombs.
But you like a platform. You like a two-dimensional platform.
Okay. Yep. I want to hold right and jump to win. That's what I want. But like when I was a kid, with a Sega Master System playing Sonic, what a world. And because you're 6, 7, you've got crazy imagination. And I would think about Sonic and write fan fiction about Sonic before I knew what fan fiction was. Me and Richard Scott and Tim Wilkinson would play Sonic in the playground. No handhelds, guys. We would literally... You be Sonic, I'll be Tails. We're going to that mountain. It was, you know, it was literally that. So I think I liked becoming an adult and going like, Sonic's still really great. So, yeah, it was easy then to do a show about 90s nostalgia, about my personal experience of 90s nostalgia. And, you know, it's like, and I've never had to shrug it off. I've never had to take off that coat. Because it's still so great.
Yes. Yeah. Do you think if what you like doing, one of the things you like doing is storytelling about your own life.
Yeah.
With an inflection of nostalgia, computer games, musicals. If that's a sort of, if that's a standard Sue's show. And I don't mean like a standard one, but.
No, but totally.
But do you, like, is that. Like, I don't know what's a standard me show. I suppose I could skewer myself with some ideas of what my standard one is. But like, is there something to be said about almost like making the same album again or making the same show again? Like, are you digging deeper or do you worry that you are retreading the same ground? Where are you on that?
Yeah. When I wrote a show called Supersonic 90s Kid in 2018, which was all about Sonic. And then in 2019, it was Mega Drive, which was more wide reaching. And they had a slightly different, like Supersonic 90s Kid was, God, if I can remember the ending, was about, you know, I'm not the best version of myself I could be. I'm not getting the good ending of my video game. Whereas 2019 was more... There's always a voice of doubt telling me I'm no good, and there's always a voice that's good telling me I'm really good, but I'm jealous of the one who's good and really chill and everything. And then you battle the bad one at the end. that was the show. So they were different, but you could easily say that was the sequel.
Yes. Okay.
So, yeah.
So are you...
There's definitely a framework.
Yeah. Are you done with Sonic now? Or do you think there is more to find in the nature of your... the, you know, who you were in your life, that nostalgic time, that kind of stuff? Is there more to be found there?
I don't think I'd do another show about Sonic, but there's so much more. Like, I did it in lockdown on Twitch, a new show, PlayStation. There's still stuff about Sonic in it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Thank you to Suze. What a joy. What a joy. And lovely to... I ran the show notes. I ran the first sentence of the show notes with her on Twitter. And she intimated that she had been having anxiety about the episode going out. And I was only too happy to tell her that anyone with any class does. So really, really great to hear from Suze again there. I hope you've enjoyed this one. There is a postamble coming up, which I recorded before the episode because I was on one and needed to talk about it. So I will give that to you just now. But extras at comedianscomedian.com/insiders. And of course, thank you to producer Nathan Wood. Your podcast consultant remains Peter Dobbing, despite an extended period of absence. Thank you to Jake Crossland for the logging and Rob Smouten for the music. That was Suze, and this is a postamble. I'll speak to you, well, seconds from now. So this is the postamble, which I'm recording before the rest of the blurbs, because I've got something on my mind. So apologies for nothing. I did a show at the weekend as part of the brilliant Gig Fest, which is the brainchild. I don't know whose brainchild it is, but it's to do with Gigless, which is Catherine Bohart's thing, what she runs with frequent co-host Helen Bauer and also Andrew White, who is an excellent comic and also a tech person of sorts, I believe. Is it reductive to describe Andrew White as the David Hoare to Catherine Bohart's Stuart Goldsmith? I mean, it's a mediumly deep cut, if it is. But my point is, I had such a great show. I had such a great time. I had such a great experience. And what it made me realise is that I'm a comic. Gang! I'm a comedian. I've spent so long. Of course, listen, this is why I'm sort of committing this to MP3 now rather than later. Because I'm just off the back of this, I'm level with you, chat with my therapist, about, like, it seems so obvious. It seems so obvious. And like a lot of things, I think a lot of the time, I can't see the wood for the trees. With comedy, for example, I'm so sort of steeped in it and asking other people about it that I tend to consider myself immune to the things that are going on around me. Like, obviously, we're all desperately missing our jobs. I've spent the year busying myself with a variety of kind of things that are a bit like comedy or that pertain to comedy, but are not sitting down and writing jokes and then delivering them. So I've done all of these corporate things I've been wanging on to you about. I've done all, you know, speaking to business about resilience. I've done hosting the Infinite Sofa, which, big news, well, let's just tease that. There might be some big news coming up. There certainly is on the 6th of April, Tuesday the 6th of April, there is the 1-year anniversary of the Infinite Sofa. And who knows, the big news may or may not be announced at that. You can find out more at infinitesofa.com. Anyway, that's not my point. My point is, been doing all of these other things, hosting and podcasting and what have you, and not sitting down and writing stand-up comedy, which I then perform. So last Monday, I could have advertised it more on this show. I could have sent more people to the festival. So apologies to everyone at GigFest for not doing that. I suppose I did a bit, but I suppose, I mean, I didn't have a show to rub together. I didn't have 5 minutes to rub together before Monday. And because I'm in the weird position of having done a work in progress at the most recent Edinburgh Festival in 2019, like, where am I? Where am I in the year, the kind of the cycle of creating and then performing stand-up? I've got new stuff, in inverted commas, that I wrote in 2018 and previewed a bit of in 2018 on the end of tour, which is still technically new because I've not done it in Edinburgh. So I'm in a very weird place. But I started writing on Monday, just gone. It's currently Monday. the current one. So I started writing 7 days ago. And crucially as well, this is a tangential but also crucial, a crucia tangent, if you will, crucially, I did what I would advise anyone to do, which the general advice I would give anyone to write a show is to work out what works for you and do that. And so within the umbrella of that, I also did what works for me, which is that I went for 3 or 4 long walks, thought about stuff, stopped in the street and made notes on a dictaphone, like typed them into my phone, and then put them all on bullet point on kind of index cards in Keynote, like presentation cards, and then talked through them with a friend, boiled them all down, and then did them. You know, there's some writing jokes in there as well, but that's kind of the shape of it, which is satisfying because that's, I was practicing what I preach. That's how I think one should do it. And not only that, it was a really incredibly fun show, but I just came away from it feeling like, oh my God, I have created a show in a week that was worth listening to and watching. And then I loved doing it and I didn't feel nervous about doing it. I felt excited to do it. And I just have this like wood for the trees. Obviously, this was staring me in the face. I've been keeping myself so busy. I've had a bit of a crisis of identity because I've been wondering whether or not I miss doing stand-up. And holy hell, this felt like creativity for creativity's sake, by which I mean whether you were there or not, whether you liked it or not, I got a tremendous amount out of it. I think it was also a success to an acceptable standard. But regardless of that, it was a success for me because I did a thing and loved it and remembered who the fuck I am. So thank you, everyone that came to that. And if you are struggling because you can't remember who the fuck you are, don't worry, you're still you. And it seems so obvious. I spent so long... I mean, you know, obviously I lay it on thick sometimes, don't I? Oh, there's no such thing as the industry. There's no such thing as reviews and awards and none of it matters. And it's all about the art, the creativity, the community and all the rest of it. And obviously, I mean, reading between the lines, it doesn't take a genius. You don't have to be Freud to work out. Freud? I was going to say you don't have to be Inspector Morse. I think that's a line from an old show I was in when I was a kid. You don't have to be Inspector fucking Morse. You don't have to know too much about psychology to clock that when a person wangs on about how reviews in the industry doesn't mean anything, maybe they're really desperately invested in reviews in the industry and they're trying to kind of override that. Of course that's the case. But part of that process, I think, is reflected in me and perhaps you trying to sort of maintain an objective position on everything as if you're not inside it. Like, you know, because this podcast arguably gives me a weird sort of tenure within the comedy industry. Like, I can keep doing this now, and it pays the mortgage at least. So I get to continue existing in a way that to me feels like tenure. Please sign up for the Insiders Club so that you can prolong my tenure. comedianscomedian.com/insiders. But I guess even without that weird idea of tenure, I think it's very easy for all of us to look at what's going on around us and go, ah, yes, I observe this, but it has no effect on me. A fucking course it has an effect on me. Of course, I at one and the same time, both things are true, aren't they? I can go, it's tough for comedians at the moment because a lot of us are out of work and don't get to get up on stage. But at the same time, I'm one of them and it's tough for me. I suppose I'm so busy trying to sort of survive mentally as well as survive financially that I've ended up feeling like, oh, that's a thing everyone has to go through. And because I've got my weird little niche and my weird little audience, that's you. Sorry, you're both weird and little. But because I've got the things that what's the phrase that's exactly the right word out there? Because I have contrived the weird little niche of which you are a part, whether you're a deep hardcore insider or whether you're a Suze Kempner fan who's listening to this going, what the fuck are you talking about? Who is this guy? Because I have that, I've been kind of quietly surviving and not really realising the extent to which I miss the thing which is, as Sarah Millican always says, I think of this all the time, it's the trunk of the fucking tree. I don't think she... That's not a direct quote, but I'm sure she'd be happy to have her name put to it. It's the trunk of the tree, the reason... Like, this podcast doesn't make any sense to me unless I am a practising comedian. And I haven't been practising. and I've just practiced, and fucking hell, it was good. Oh, man. So, ultimately, to point the flashlight beam away from my own face, just at the end, and point it into your face, I am sure that if you're a creative person and your creativity has been, you've had to pivot, you've been, God, I've been celebrating pivoting, but what has pivoting cost us? You know, if you are a creative person and you are wondering who the fuck you are anymore, as I have been for a year, then the news from dipping a toe into doing it properly again is that you're still you, it's all still there, it's going to be all right. All right? And while I think of it, do sign up for the Insiders Club, because you will not only get access to the recent James Acaster special Zoom Q&A, but you will also, in a couple of weeks, I will release the audio of the Nish Kumar Insiders-only Zoom Q&A that we did, which was a cracking hour of magnificent conversation with the man himself. So, as well as that, over 100 hours of extras from all the episodes that have them. Let's say 100 episodes of extras. Some of them are between 15 and 45 minutes long. I don't think it's 100 hours, but Christ knows by this stage it may as well be. So please do sign up and continue my tenure. Loads more great things to come. Delightful sausage next week and more exciting people after that. Speak soon.